Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
We're back at 12 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. That's Mr. Mark Knopfler on guitar. He's one of the best. The only thing I envy him for is I know he cut an album with Chet Atkins once, and I have a copy of that. And so I envy him the fact that he got to play guitar with Chet Atkins. One of the things I always wanted to do, but I never got to. Somebody else who has always wanted to play guitar, who always wanted to play guitar with Chet Atkins, is our good friend and our guest this hour, Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, welcome back.
Hello there, Jim. Gee, I didn't realize you knew that about me.
Yeah, I knew that was like
wow.
Something you always
thought that was
to
a
do.
Secret. Yeah.
Well, I've blown that, haven't I?
Boy, yeah. Sorry about that.
Joan, it's big doings in Washington, D.C. today.
Wow, it's been a crazy week, and it's a big day today. Yeah.
Yeah, we're swearing in the 43rd president of the United States again for the second
again.
Time.
That's right. We sure
and,
are.
You know, there's there's not any controversy about this, but I thought I'd try to make some, Joan.
Oh, go ahead.
You're off today.
Yes. Well, no. Wait a minute. Hold on one second. I work for Kiplinger. I am working at home today. I was given that choice because we are in a restricted area. Our office is in a restricted area of the downtown area, so getting in and out would be really hard today.
And so that's the reason you're at home, allegedly working at home.
Yes, I will be, and I am right now.
Yeah, well, you are working right now with me, but
that's right.
But
and
that's
it's
the story,
work.
That's
believe
the story
me,
you're sticking to, right?
That's right.
Okay, now, but federal workers in D.C. are off today, and they get a full vacation day, don't they?
Right.
I mean, they have to do no work.
That's right.
But federal workers outside of D.C. have to go to work. Now, I would think there would be a groundswell of resentment and maybe even like a revolt or something over this.
Well, the revolution hasn't started yet. I think this is, I don't know that this is unprecedented. I'm sure this has happened before. The only reason they're doing this is because it's not in order to celebrate the inauguration. It's in order to keep downtown from being a total nightmare. Because
it's a practical matter.
It's a practical matter. There's a whole wide swath of downtown that is just completely closed to traffic.
But there still are some people who are getting a day off and others aren't. And it's just that we just need to rectify this imbalance.
Wow, how are you going to do that?
I don't know, but we need to fix that.
I hope you're able to sleep tonight over this.
Well, I'm trying to create a little controversy, and
we don't
have enough things to be upset about.
Right.
Joan, I mentioned earlier just before you got here that I've been thinking about this inauguration thing, and on the one hand, it's the second inauguration of a president we already have, and so should we be making as big a deal out of it? And on the other hand, I think, you know what? There's something pretty cool about a country like America that where we do this, we've been doing it now consistently and on schedule for all these years, all these centuries, I should say, we really ought to be. We ought to think about it as a celebration of democracy, shouldn't we?
Well, I think there's also the question that has been raised, and I'm not saying I raised it, but I've heard this raised, that asking the question of should we be having big, fancy parties celebrating this inauguration in the middle of a war?
Right.
And I think the answer was, well, since we're fighting for freedom, allegedly, then why not celebrate freedom? I think that's what the answer was that came through.
That was kind of Giuliani's message, a former mayor of New York, and he said, we need to stop and take time to celebrate sometimes.
Right.
And so I think that's a good idea, and I'm not sure how much bipartisan celebration is going to be in Washington D.C. this week, but I do think we need to celebrate. By the way, Joan, I have some information here. Thanks to an article that Michael Barone wrote and was published in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, you may have seen this. These numbers surprised me. Did you see this article?
Which article is it?
The Michael Barone article, the 16th.
Well, I don't really look at bylines, so I'm not sure which article you mean.
Well, this is the 16th second inaugural in the last 112 years.
Wow!
Think about that. In other words, they're there have not been, there have only been 16 second inaugurations in the history of the United States.
Well, that's because we have a lot of, I think we had a lot of one-term presidents,
well, yeah,
particularly
right,
in the last century.
Would you have thought that there would have been that few? I guess it surprised me that there were only 16.
Well, given the number of one-term presidents we have, if we've had, I guess not. But if you're not a student
thing
of history, then I guess you would be surprised.
Here's another one. Here's the one that blows you away. It is the first time, I'm quoting Michael Barone again now, it will be the first time that one president has delivered a second inaugural just 8 years after another one since James Monroe in 1821. Only the second time that we've had back-to-back, 8 year apart, in second inaugurations. How about that?
Oh, I see what you're saying. In other words, two-term presidents in a row.
In a row, and that they were, you know, and that there was no interruption by because of death or resignation or anything like that.
Right.
George Washington had the shortest inaugural address, 135 words.
Boy, I like that.
Yeah.
You gotta like that.
And who was it? Let's see. James Monroe in 1821. His went on for more than an hour.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Well, the famous one was one of the Harrison presidents,
yep,
who spoke for so long that he gave himself pneumonia and died.
Yeah, 30 days later he was out.
Yes.
I hope, you know, and I got to thinking about that, Joan. I was thinking about, you know, why do we do this? Why do we have an election in November and an inauguration in January? Why don't we do this in May and July or something?
Well, as you know, we used to do it in March.
Yeah.
And then they decided, and I think rightly so, that there was such a big gap between election and inauguration that they wanted to shorten it. Unfortunately, they should have moved the election day as well,
right,
period of the year.
But then you think, though, that, of course, we could do it more now, but in those days, they probably had the schedule based on the agrarian calendar.
Well, and they also probably had to have such a big gap in order to give people time to prepare and get to where they needed to go.
Right. Well, but you also think about November, the November election. That's such cold weather for a lot of the country. And you would think that they would have it more in the summer. But again, it makes me wonder if they didn't wait till people had their crops laid by in the fall.
Oh, I'm sure.
And so, you know, you think about it, Joan. How much of our traditions are based on the agrarian calendar?
That's right.
Including the school year, right?
That's right, and things like daylight savings time.
Absolutely, no question about it. Joan, stand by. We're going to take a quick break, folks. We're through talking about it, the inauguration, but other than just to say congratulations to Mr. Bush, and we will be talking about labor and jobs and hiring and firing and those kinds of things when we come back right after these messages. It's 20 after. Stay with us. Here's Robert Crane. Take us out. You're not sitting there alone. I'm happy.
Love, love is strange. Lot of people take it for a game.
We're back. It's 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're visiting with our good friend Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, the lead story is all about jobs this week in the Kiplinger Letter, isn't it?
That's right.
Now, I saw the other day that as of, I don't know, sometime in 2004, maybe December, I don't know, fourth quarter, that every job that has been lost since the recession, since 9/11, et cetera, has now been recovered.
That's pretty good. No, I have not seen that. That's pretty good.
That the jobs that we have now, but now here's, to me, that's not the big news.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, and I believe it because I heard it from, it was a bipartisan report. It wasn't any kind of a, it didn't come out of the White House or anything. It was some kind of a bipartisan report. Or nonpartisan, I should say. The news, though, is that you also have to remember that it now is believed that as the recession began in 2000, we had 2 million people employed more than we needed. We had overemployed in America by 2 million people.
Wow. How do they define that?
The Fed. I got that from my friends in the Fed.
Yeah, but how does that, what does that mean?
By what they were basing it on the jobs that people had that were for companies that really had no value. They were propped up by by, you know, the irrational exuberance. They, they hired people that they didn't need, and they were funded by, basically, they weren't funded by sales. They weren't supported by any kind of market activity. They were supported by the ability to raise capital.
Oh, okay.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that and that came from the Fed. That 2,000 overemployed came from the Fed. And and so if you take my point is that to me that's an indication. If and as you know, Joan, we don't. You know, there are very few people today who are overemployed.
Oh, that's right.
You know, if you got a job, somebody's decided that they need you.
Right.
And it's based on performance and activity, not some kind of irrational exuberance. So my point is in 4 years or so, we have grown our economy by two million jobs.
Wow, that's quite a lot.
So that's good. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, what you guys are saying is that there's more to come.
Well, we're saying a net job gain of 2.4 million jobs in, if I'm reading this correctly, in 2005.
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me. That's now that's pretty froggy, Joan. I'm a pretty optimistic forecaster, but you guys got me beat.
Yeah, and we've been so dour lately. I'm surprised at us.
Well, maybe somebody just woke up on the right side of the bed. They woke up with a happy face or something.
Could be.
What do you
think? Or they took uppers or something. I don't know.
I wasn't going to get into the whole drug thing, Joan.
Now, it's interesting. We also say 5% joblessness, which I think we mean 5% unemployment rate, which sounds high, relatively speaking. But if you're creating that many jobs, I guess 5% isn't that bad.
Well, Joan, in the heyday of the economy back in like 99 or so. Mm-hmm. It was down to, you know, it was down to 4% or so.
Right, and we were asking how low can it go?
4.3, yeah.
But what is full employment?
I also heard that they're now, you know, we used to say 4% unemployment was kind of the norm. That was a pretty good indicator of a good economy because 4% of the population is always going to be unemployed. I think now they're thinking 5% is that number.
I see.
And by the way, that number tracks with what I predicted. You'll be glad to know, Joan.
I was worried
that at the end of 2000, we would have a 5% unemployment rate. I know you're so happy to hear about that. But the interesting thing, though, Joan, and you guys really did a great job of this week, folks. I hope those of you who subscribed to the Kiplinger letter, you got a copy of this.
You got to tell them what you're looking at, Jim.
I'm looking at this. But give me a second, Joan. Don't get excited.
I'm already excited.
I'm looking at this
it's
white
so pretty.
And green and tan map.
It's not a blue map. You'd think there was another electoral map.
Exactly. It's beautiful, Joan. And it looks great, but it identifies the strong, the moderate, and the weak growth areas. Now, Joan, if you're a small business owner in America, this is a graphic you need to be looking at.
Boy, no question about it.
And comparing your activity to what's going on. And Joan, the growth and the weakness is kind of in pockets, isn't it?
That's right.
It's
exactly.
Not so much spread around. It's a little spread around, but not much.
No, there's definitely clusters here of states.
So the Mountain West, excluding California, I mean, it's just a whole belt of strong jobs growth.
That's right. And a pretty solid block there.
Yeah, I mean, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. Let's see, that's eight states all clustered together there.
Right, exactly.
And that's you call that strong growth.
Yes, we do.
So, and Florida is another one. Hawaii is another one, and New Hampshire, that great bastion of conservatism, New Hampshire, in that island of conservatism in the Granite State in New England, New Hampshire. Now, Joan, when I look up there at that and I see New Hampshire surrounded by tan states, I want to say, what's wrong with that picture?
And to tell your listeners, tan states are the states with weak growth.
That's right. Thank you for helping me remember that. Absolutely. Very interesting. Folks, this is a dynamite graphic. I hope you figure out a way to get it. And you know what? If you subscribe to their letter, and I'll tell you how to do that in a minute, you can get that this week. 29 after. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now it's time to go home. And he makes it fast. One more thing.
Now back to Ringside with the voice of small business and the champion of the entrepreneur.
Say it now, gentlemen. Undisputed heavyweight champion of the world.
The small business advocate, Jim Blasingame.
We're back. It's 34 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, and I'm glad you're here. I'm glad Joan Pride is here, too. We have a great visit with her every week, talking about what Kiplinger has to say about what's going on in the world these days. And folks, we're talking about this map. Joan, I if they subscribe pretty soon, they can still get this edition, can't they?
Well, to be honest, I have no idea, which I think a subscription would start with whatever the next issue would be.
Okay.
But I'm sure
today,
But I would think if they asked for it, if they said they was really they were really interested in it, I am sure Kiplinger would be happy to make this a gift to them.
I really would like for you to have this graphic, folks. Here's the website, Kiplinger.com, K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R.com. The next edition of Kiplinger comes out tomorrow. So I believe that if you subscribe today or tomorrow morning maybe, but again, as Joan said, make sure that you say to them, that please send me the copy with the graphic about the jobs.
I tell you what, if they say they can't do that, tell them that you want to speak to me.
Yeah.
And have them transfer the phone to me, and I'll send it to you.
Or email me, folks, at jim@jbsba.com, or ask jim@jbsba, either one of those, and we'll make sure you get this. This is a really dramatic thing that I'd like for small business owners to see how their state stacks up based on your numbers here. And give us that phone number, Joan.
That's right. Our toll-free number is 800-544-0155. Now, that's subscriber services. It's not the editor's building in Washington where I work, but I'm sure they will have a general number that they'll route you through, and they'll get you to me if they can't help you. But they're really nice people at subscriber services, so I think that if you say, you know, I've heard about the January 14th letter with the great map, can you throw that in? I'm sure they'd be happy to do it.
Tell them it's the jobs map, and you want to make sure you get it. But also,
yeah, January 14th.
There's also one other thing. You get 30 days free. They're going to let
that's
you try
right.
it out for 30 days.
The
Kiplinger letter, that's the Washington letter.
Right.
Also the agriculture letter. They also have these are biweekly, folks. Every other week is the agriculture, the tax letter, and the California letter. And you also can do the same thing with the magazine, Joan.
That's right, Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine.
So check out the website and give us that phone number again.
All right, the toll free number is 800-544-0155.
The other states that I mentioned the cluster of. That you guys identified in the mountain states, the western mountain states, not counting California. California is a moderate state, moderate growth, but also Alaska is seen as a weak state. Joan, it sort of ends as you go north through Washington. It stops off there in Alaska. Hawaii is seen as a growth state, but Alaska is seen as a weak state.
That's right.
And the cluster of other weak states. Are what's called the Rust Belt, Joan.
Now, the one thing I should say, the difference between strong and weak generally is not that wide. I'm looking at the strongest state here is Florida, and that percentage is 3.5%. Now, the weakest I'm seeing is there anything weaker than 1.4 in Alaska? I don't think so.
I think Alabama is 1.0.
Okay, Alabama's 1.0, and Louisiana's 1.0.
Yep.
But Florida's North Dakota is, North Dakota is 0.9.
Yeah.
Now, Florida is kind of way out there because generally the strong states are in the sort of the 2% plus range.
I think Florida's spike there is based a lot on probably based a lot on the reconstruction.
And we say that, yeah, hurricane rebuilding.
You point that out. Okay, good.
Right.
Good. Well, then you would be right, Joan.
We would. Oh, I feel so much better.
If you agree with me, that would make you right.
I feel a lot better.
But anyway, it's interesting to see when we talk about the state being politically divided, it's also divided from a standpoint of jobs opportunity, isn't it?
Oh, no question about it, right.
And this is really a fascinating graphic, folks. I mean, a lot of times, you know, you can talk about things, you can write about them, you can read about them, but when you see something like this laid out in a graphic, it's really dramatic. Joan, let's move over and talk about business costs. One of the things you guys point out is that you got good news on software prices. Well, what's going on? Is that because of the competition?
Exactly. Software vendors are competing with each other like crazy, and so prices are going to be driven down. We're saying by 10 to 15% a year, and not just this year, but over the next few years. So that's pretty good.
Well, you know, Joan, I also wonder about this. There's maybe less R&D now to develop a software project, because a lot of software companies, they have their models, they have their templates, they've already paid for a certain amount of the infrastructure for getting some of these products to market. It's taking less time to get them to market, it's less expensive. And plus the competition, as you know, software companies have been a very profitable business over the years. And so now that they got all this extra competition, they're having to tighten up their pricing a little bit. I got one more thought about that too when we come back after these messages. 22, we'll be right back with Joan Pride, senior editor with a Kiplinger editor. We're back at 17 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and Joan Pride is our guest. Joan, we were talking about how competitive the software prices are going to be.
That's right.
Kipling reported on that this week, and I wonder. Part of it is just the natural; it's the way of things. The software industry is maturing, isn't it?
That's true.
And so when a mature industry, the prices level out more and more, they become more commodities. And it's hard to think about, you know, a dynamic and exciting software being commodities, but we may be kind of getting to that stage. But the other things I worried about with regard to the prices coming down, I also wonder if that is also a reflection of maybe not as many things being developed.
Hmm.
Think about that. See, because if you develop software, you are going to have new software, new approaches. You got a new company coming out there,
right,
a whole new killer app or something like that. You got a lot of money in that. You're going to have to charge a lot. So I worry a little bit in my role as the technology advocate. I worry, Joan, that maybe companies are not developing as much as they used to, and that we're not going to. We may be happy with the prices of the software we have, but we may be missing some opportunities that we would have otherwise had prices been up a little bit.
Oh, okay.
I also worry about lawsuits, the frivolous lawsuits that we see, and I worry about the antitrust thing that Microsoft went through. I wonder how many people out there are looking at what happened to Microsoft and saying, you know what, we don't need that.
Yeah. Well, you worry a lot.
Well, let me tell you something. We were warning people about this.
Yes.
4 years ago, 5 years ago.
When
I was covering the Microsoft trial on the show, I was warning people, me and the people who think like me, Jonathan Zook and Steve Del Bianco and others, when, you know, we felt that Microsoft was being treated badly. And so I wonder if maybe the chickens are coming home to roost a little bit on this industry.
Could be, yeah.
So that'll be something to watch for, folks. And just in case you needed something else to keep you up at night. But you guys say it's going to be a buyer's market for smaller mid-companies. So maybe it's a good thing.
Well, at least in the short term, we're saying that I guess vendors are going to take the versions of some of these programs that they have originally built for large firms and bring it down to the scale of smaller firms and cut the cost at the same time.
Right. Yep, and also, Joan, you guys are pretty close to my prediction on the fuel thing here. You're saying the fuel prices are not going to come down, they're going to resume again.
Boy, I know, more bad news here, and we're saying that tight supplies is the reason, and that's going to drive everything.
I predicted that petroleum would be an average above $40 a gallon. You know, a lot of people thought that we might get on down below 40, and
right.
I predicted
right.
it would not be below 40. Would average above that, and that gasoline prices across the country would average $1.70, but that's actually a lot rosier than your picture here.
Sure, we're saying oil may top $55 a barrel by spring, and that's, again, because OPEC is cutting its output.
Right, right. Another thing, Joan, that I'd like to stick in here on business costs that have gone up a lot. And that is, in addition to the perennial health insurance issue, but it's just it's the whole insurance issue, not just health insurance, but liability coverage has gone up a lot.
Right, and that's been true, gosh, for quite a while now. And I thought that some of that was moderating, but maybe it's not.
It's been since 9/11, John. Do you remember when what's his name with Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett? Warren Buffett said that you could tell after 9/11 that he made some comments that led us to believe that he felt like the insurance companies, the big insurers, the six or seven major underwriters in the world, had not been charging enough to put it back as a reserve for liability.
Oh, okay.
And when he made those comments, I said, okay, buddy, better buckle up. Here comes the price increase.
Right.
And that's
what right.
Happened.
He tends to be right.
Right. So the insurance, that's another big thing on business costs. Joan, let's move on down and talk about federal spending. What's going to be happening there?
Well, as everybody knows, we're going to have pretty high levels of defense spending.
Mm-hmm.
But we do say that some weapons programs are going to be scaled back. And so in amid all that, you have to be careful if you are a subcontractor involved with one of these systems that may create problems.
President Bush says he's going to cut the deficit in half. Did he say that by the end of his term, or is it going to be over the next several years? I've forgotten.
I thought it was by the end of the second term.
Maybe that's what it was. But the point is, that's his goal, to be headed in that direction. They got to stop spending somewhere, don't they?
That's right.
Now, I'm waiting on, I think we should have a $40 million celebration when he performs his first veto.
That's right. He has yet to do so.
That's what I'm waiting on. Joan, moving over to page three, the World Bank is making some changes. And one of the things that I noted here in your comment is that Mr. Bush wants the World Bank to make more outright grants of money to the poorest countries instead of loaning them the money to be saddled with the debt.
Right. And as you know, these poor countries get this huge debt, and then they're not able to pay it back. And it tends to be kind of a vicious cycle, so that a grant may make, in some cases, more sense.
So it's kind of a little dance that we do, isn't it? We loan them the money, then something bad happens, and we just say, okay, don't worry about it.
Right. Are we really trying to help them improve their situation?
Play the charade? Is that what he's saying?
Right, I think so.
But now, one of the things you guys don't point out that I'm thinking is going to happen any time is if this happens, they're going to change the name from the World Bank to World Santa. What do you think?
Ooh, that sounds good. I like
bye.
That.
Cynthia, we're going to be right back with Joan Prize, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. When we come back, we're going to talk about lots of other stuff, jobs and space business and health care, stuff like that. Stay with us.
When I die in the name of Therese, gonna go.
We're back at 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and Joan Prize is our guest. Folks, I want to remind you, I hope you get a chance to get this graphic, and you can do it by going to Kiplinger.com and subscribing for get their 30-day free trial, and encourage them to send you the January 14th edition. Or, Joan, go ahead and give us that phone number again.
You mean our toll-free number?
Yeah.
Sure. It's 800-544-0155.
All right, and tell them that you want this edition, and I think you'll enjoy it. Joan, let's move down and talk about home shoring. Tell us what that is.
Well, boy, this was a new term I hadn't seen before I saw it in the letter. I mean, I think we used to call it telecommuting, but we're seeing, this is just talking about employees working from their homes, but now it's being employed on a much larger scale so that employees from far, far away can work for a company and not have to leave their home.
Mm-hmm. So instead of going... I guess the way I understand it, instead of offshoring like a call center business to a
place in India
somewhere where there's a whole bunch of people gaggled together in a building, actually bringing those jobs home and placing them and wiring people up in their homes to answer these phones.
Right, which I think could be pretty revolutionary for certain people who must be home, say stay-at-home moms, for example.
It's revolutionary not from the home... From the home office, I mean, from the teleworking thing, as you mentioned, Joan, but it's revolutionary from the standpoint of not having everybody under one roof.
Right.
And see, that's something, Joan, that you know that I've been talking about this for a long time, ever since 9/11. Remember?
Yes.
When I said after they interviewed that fire chief, and he said, they asked him, would you build these buildings back? And he said, who would occupy them?
Right, right.
Hundreds of thousands of New York workers went to their homes with their laptops, and when their bosses called them a year later and said, we have the new offices ready, they said, I'm not coming.
Why bother?
We've been doing this for a year successfully. And I said then, Joan, if you remember, that 911, one of the byproducts of 911 was going to kickstart teleworking and like a rocket and make it proliferate.
I think that's true, and I think one of the things that it helped prove to some bosses that when your employee is at home, that yes, they still are working, because those people had to still produce product and to show they were working. But I still think it's a tough sell with employers that are not used to that concept.
That's the key. So you hit it right on the head. The technology is there. The people are ready to go. It's a matter of whether the management culture, can the manager get his or her hands around the fact that he doesn't or she doesn't have all their little chickens under one roof?
Right.
But here's the question, and I wrote an article about this, Joan. I asked this question. How many times during a typical day do you communicate with an employee in the same building as you and never see them all day long, maybe all week long? They're 300 feet away, and you never see them.
Well, I know in my office we have this tendency. When people want to talk to you, they kind of wander into your office to talk to you, which I find interesting. It's very nice, the face-to-face. But I often think, why did this person take the time to get up and come into my office? They could have easily picked up the phone. Why didn't they just do that?
Right.
Because
you
might get to someone's office and find they're not there, or they're on the phone, and you've wasted the trip.
Exactly. And the technology prevents that from being necessary.
Right.
And this is something that's happening. And I really commend Joan. I commend Kiplinger for being the first that I've ever seen to overlay the offshoring angle in this.
Yes.
Very smart. Very good.
Oh, thank you.
And folks, this is the reason why you pay attention to Kiplinger.
Right.
Bring these things up. They're the first people I've ever seen. And as you know, folks, I track these things. And so this is the first time I've seen it. I was really excited to see you guys to do this, Joan. Joan, let's move over and talk about let's talk a little bit about the trade czar. Over on page 4, you guys say there's a new trade czar who will reap the benefit of that today's trade czar sowed. Zelnick, Robert Zelnick, who I've worked with a little bit, is a U.S. Trade Representative, and he's leaving to go to State Department, isn't he?
That's right. He'll be Condoleezza Rice's deputy there. So there's an opening in case somebody wants to apply.
I actually, kind of threw that balloon up over there, and I haven't heard anybody. Nobody's called me back about that, Joan.
Well, they're busy right now at the inauguration.
Exactly. That's probably what it is.
I
had a great experience. They asked me to come and moderate a panel with a trade group from South Africa, the South African Union. Five nations down there that came over small business, and I worked with his group. That was enjoyable. He's a good guy, and he's done some good work over there in the U.S. Trade Representative's office. And it'll be interesting to see how that rolls out and how that helps small businesses in the days ahead. Joan,
right.
Thank you for being here. Happy Inauguration Day.
Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Enjoy your day off, Joan.
Not true.
I'll see you next time.
Okay.
Joan Pride, ladies and gentlemen, she'll be back. Got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.